Let's get started, everyone. Good morning. It's wonderful to see all of the faces and all the places behind the faces. That's one of the neat things about this type of connection, I think. Happy spring to everyone. It is March 28th today as we are having this gathering together, and the seasons are shifting here in southern Minnesota. We're really noticing the warmth the past few weeks, the increased light the past few weeks, and on my walks, I'm noticing now just the very beginnings of some buds on the lilac bushes that are near my house. So it does feel like spring is, in fact, going to happen. The miracle that happens every year, that usually midwinter I begin to doubt. There's probably a whole Dharma talk in just that, but what happens every spring is just a hint of the thing, as my Benedictine friends say. So I want to talk this morning about a short poem that has a springtime feel to it to me, because it's about wildflowers, and wildflowers have that kind of spring vibe. This is by our friend Isa. I've put it in the chat there for all of you if you want to look at it. He's very widely translated, so it's quite possible that you'd be able to find different translations of the same haiku online if you were to look. And Isa is one of the masters, one of the five Japanese haiku masters, and he was a Buddhist. And I think last time I gave a talk about Isa, I said he was a Zen guy. He's not a Zen guy, he's a Buddhist guy. And although there's overlap between those two things, they are not synonymous. So I sometimes am clumsy in my speech. I know a lot of us can be if we're so immersed in just one expression of a tradition, we start to imagine that it is the tradition, and that's not accurate. But Isa had a very Buddhist sensibility in his writing. And for those of us familiar with his work, we see a lot of Dharma. We can find a lot of Dharma in it, especially the tenderheartedness and the compassion that he expresses for all living beings and all living systems, especially what he would have seen as the marginalized or overlooked or oppressed or ignored. And he also has recurrent themes of ephemerality. Impermanence, things being kind of vanishing before his eyes. And of course, we all know impermanence is one of the marks of existence in our Buddhist tradition. So we see a lot of Dharma in the work of Isa. He offered us a lot in the form of his haiku. So our haiku today, which I will read for you in case you don't have the text there in front of you, is "Such intricate wildflowers bloomed in one short night. Such intricate wildflowers bloomed in one short night." Such a space he creates for us there. Such a space. So, like all poetry, and like a lot of more interpretive dharma, especially more poetic dharma, I think there's a lot of doorways in here, a lot of possibilities for interpretation. So I'll just share with you what struck me about this little poem, and I invite you to spend time with the poem on your own and see what it might have to offer you. Surely your discoverings about your own heart mind are of primary importance to your practice, right? So I'll offer you what it awoke in me, but this is just what it awoke in me. So the way that this has been translated into English, we've added some punctuation, whoever translated this, and broke it down into the two pieces that haiku oftentimes come in. "Such intricate wildflowers bloomed!" exclamation point, in one short night, to kind of highlight the wonder, the surprise. Right? Wow. So it's easy for me to imagine him waking up and seeing the very same landscape that he had seen the day before, and yet noticing a dramatic shift in such a short amount of time, one short night, to see how much growth had happened. And part of the power in that idea for me, not only is that growth happens sometimes in spurts, it can happen very, very suddenly, which can feel like hope for us, right? But also that it happened without him being aware of it, right? Dogen, in our own Soto Zen tradition, reminds us, do not necessarily think you'll be aware of enlightenment, right? Or aware of your own enlightenment. Don't necessarily think you're going to notice that happening, or even be able to recognize it when it's there. So growth happening during the dark is one of the things that really moves me about this piece. A short, dark time. And dark times can have tremendous transformative potential. And I'm aware of how much more I see that I feel it's safe to say we collectively see in this city, in this country, in this world, as a result of the dark times that we've been living in the past year or so. Sometimes opening up our eyes can feel like living in a different version of the world. Lots of intricate wildflowers bloomed in the past year from very, very dark places. And awareness in the Zen tradition is, of course, our wildflower. We even trace our origins. The Zen tradition traces its origins all the way back to the single flower, right, held up by the Buddha as one of his talks, the wordless talk, the flower sermon of just the flower. And so we've, I think, all known that these past months, even years, but certainly the past year of COVID and the lockdown, the pandemic, and all that we've noticed about our human experience have illuminated places that we hadn't seen in quite the same way before, that had been left unexplored or left unacknowledged or even ignored. And so darkness can sometimes challenge how we see and how we know. And very much, I think, the Zen tradition of Buddhism is definitely about making a decision, an intentional choice to choose to see what we are able to see, to choose to know what we are able to know, and to choose as deeply as we are capable to accept the reality, to explore, inquire about our crucial place in it. And so what happens during darkness and what happens during the night is part of where this poem takes me. And Issa in our little poem is describing night of not only a time of growth, but of actual blooming, because he's using the flower as the metaphor, as opposed to a vine that gets longer or a leaf that gets, you know, or roots that go deeper into the soil, right? And we tend as humans, because of our senses, right, to think of night as something real. We experience it as a very separate entity. We tend to think of it as a time of increased danger, again, because of our senses, right? It's a time for us of less visual knowing. We are less certain visually, and we're very visually oriented creatures, a lot of us. But because our vision sense is limited, we can perceive less via the sense gate of vision than we can during what we call the day. And for us, less seeing seems to equate to less knowing, and less knowing seems to equate to more danger. And more danger causes us to experience more of the emotional state that we call fear, right? Night is associated with fear. But objectively, actual danger doesn't really change much at night. Only our perception does. And experience through the lens of fear, through the lens of the emotional state that we call fear, which leads us to aversion, right? Night is A, a real thing, right? And B, a dangerous thing. And it is therefore not a time of exploration or growth, let alone a time of blooming, right? As Issa is inviting us to experience, right? So let's look at this a little bit. Let's look at the dark. What is dark? Right? This is spring. We're coming into a time of more light, less dark. Well, let's look at that. I saw a wonderful little passage on Twitter the other day that I'll read for you. When the world seems dark, I remind myself that Mr. Rogers once got a letter from a blind girl who wrote that she had heard him say that he owned fish, but she worried that they weren't being fed. So at the end of every following show, he would narrate, "I'm feeding the fish," just for her. When the world seems dark, I remind myself that Mr. Rogers once got a letter from a blind girl who wrote that she had heard him say that he owned fish, but worried that they weren't being fed. So at the end of every following show, he would narrate, "I'm feeding the fish," just for her. For those of us who grew up watching Mr. Rogers, I remember very clearly watching him scatter the food atop the little aquarium he had and say, "I'm feeding the fish. It's time to feed the fish. Let's go feed the fish." One of the things I like about the way this was written was the choice of the words, "when the world seems dark." That's talking about subjective perception, right? Instead of "when the world is dark." The world seems dark. That's correct, right? But strictly speaking, we're humans, right? So the world never actually gets dark or light. The only difference is actually us in our subjective perception of our individual sense organs. We perceive more reflected light or we perceive less reflected light, right? And as an interesting side note, we humans can see 0.0035% of the light spectrum. 0.0035%, right? And I saw an article recently that says scientists have now discovered that hummingbirds can perceive colors we can't, right? They're there, they're happening right now. We just can't perceive them, right? Because of the limitations of our sense organs. So we have to imagine them, right? Like Gru and Reen and Rello and Yed, to make up new words for new colors, but we can't see them, right? So the world seems dark to most of us at night. To that blind girl who wrote that letter to Mr. Rogers, no day, no night. Right? For other animals, for other species, for other even humans, our perception of light and dark is very, very different, right? And the second key about this little nice story, the little Mr. Rogers story that I like so much, is that even though she cannot see with her eyes what is happening, she knows that the fish are being fed. So she's being cared for because someone is telling her that that's happening. There are more ways of knowing, right? And being cared for, caring for ourselves, recognizing where we are supported, such an important part of our practice. All of the ways, there are so many ways in which we are being cared for, that we are being helped, that we are being supported, that we just do not recognize. Right? Just like colors we can't see, they're happening now. Suzuki Roshi has a really pointed teaching about this. He said, "Buddha is always helping you, but usually we refuse Buddha's offer. For instance, sometimes you ask for something special. This means you are refusing to accept the treasures you already have. You are like a pig. When I was young, my father was very poor, and he raised many pigs. And I noticed that when I gave the pigs a bucket of food, they would eat it after I went away. As long as I was there, they wouldn't eat it, hoping I would give them more food. I had to be very careful. If I moved too quickly, they would kick the bucket over. I think that is what you are doing. Just to cause yourself more problems, you seek for something. But there is no need for you to seek for anything. You have plenty. And you have just enough problems. This is a mysterious thing, you know, the mystery of life. We have just enough problems, never too many or too few." Isn't that an interesting Dharma teaching? I love that he equates our grasping nature, greed, right? Like you're asking for more problems. The thing you think you want is going to, right? You have plenty. Buddha is always helping you. So we may not be able to see, of course, as much during the night that we as what we can see during the day. But we also have to know we have lots of ways of knowing, just like the little girl can know the fish are being fed in more than one way. And also, we do not have to stay stuck in our belief in the night, nor do we have to stay stuck in the belief that the darkness is an enemy, or that not knowing is an enemy, or my lack of recognition of how I am supported means I am not being supported. We can see instead how our fear, which we inherit honestly and has been a friend, can also cloud our perception and limit our experience of being alive, and it can obscure our wise mind. And meditation practice and Zen practice teach us that all of this can be adjusted with practice, right? We can remember our other ways of knowing. We can remember the wise mind, the large space that holds the small experience of fear, right? We can be reminded, which is why we sit every day, right? Part of why we sit every day. So it seems right, to me at least, for a bunch of reasons, that although we leave our eyes open during our zazen, we face a blank wall. Vision as a sense, vision as a way of knowing, is affirmed. We leave our eyes open, right? But it's not the one that's emphasized. We face the wall. We face the wall because our gaze is cast inward and not outward. Right? We all know this. In zazen, we go in. We go in to make the implicit explicit. We see the myth for what it is. Oh, right. Night is just a fancy word to describe a sense of perceptions and sometimes an emotion, but it's not real any more than self, any more than permanence, any more than, right? This is what we're encouraged to do throughout Buddhism, but boy, especially in the Zen tradition, right? Make the implicit explicit. Turn the light inwardly to illuminate the self, as Dogen says. And then he actually goes on, this is from Fukan Zazengi, to say that when we do this, we're like a dragon gaining the water, like a tiger settling into the mountains. That recalls in me the same feeling as wildflowers blooming in the night. It's dark, and yet the thing happens naturally. It's wildflower nature to bloom. Dragon gaining the water nature. The tiger's nature to settle in to the mountain. Human, part of our human nature, to gaze inwardly and go, oh, what is this? What is this? What really is this, right? And obviously the point of zazen, of turning the light inwards in Soto Zen, is to actualize enlightenment, to actualize the activity of enlightenment itself. That is to say, to shine the light of awareness and to see what we hadn't previously seen, to know what we hadn't previously known, is enlightenment. Right? Why else would we call it enlightenment if it didn't mean to enlighten? Like, of course, that's what it is, to see something you haven't seen before, to know something you haven't known before, to bring light to something that was previously dark. That's implicit in the entire tradition, right? If we actually meant try to escape darkness or difficulty or suffering or pain by dissociating into trance states and speculative fantasy, we'd have called it something other than enlightenment. And our zazen would be very, very different. So zazen, the actualization of enlightenment, the moment of meeting darkness with light, with awareness, that which is unknown with that which is known. Zazen is an activity then of discovery. It is a discovery activity. We are called upon to be explorers in Zen. And as explorers, we're driven by the curiosity, right? To go out. And in this case, the out is in, because this is spiritual practice, right? We go in. But we explore the frontier for the sake of participation in, and we explore for the sake of connection to, inclusion of whatever we find. That seems important because in our country, the exploration pioneer spirit has not always been done in the spirit of participation in, connection to, and inclusion with. It's important to recognize we can explore for lots of different reasons. We are looking to learn. We are looking to make friends. We are looking to help those who may need it and to accept help from those who may offer it. You can feel that, I hope, in all of Zen tradition, ahimsa, nonviolence. We explore to better understand the lines that have been drawn on maps, and sometimes to erase those lines, sometimes to redraw them. But we do not explore to claim or to steal or to conquer or to own. Remember, this is an internal landscape. I am talking, we're using the metaphor of going in, of going out to represent going in. I'm exploring landscapes within myself, areas of memory, areas of emotion, patterning of thought, the human experience that shows up inside of this one unique body, and I'm exploring it with the spirit of, the hope of learning, making friends, understanding, helping, offering, being helped, being supported, discovering. That's what I'm going in to do. I'm not going in with my egoic consciousness to try to claim or steal or conquer or own. And it's a very different energy, right? So the places in us that we do not understand and we do not know, that we can't see, or the ones we tend to avoid or ignore or deny because of our fear. This is our reaction to the dark. It's harder to go out during the night. We're scared of what might be out there. It's harder to go into the places in us that we don't recognize. I don't know that place. I don't understand what that feeling means. I don't really get that aversion. I don't really understand why I'm so avoidant of that person, of that idea, right? What is that about? What is that about is a saying yes and being curious about and turning toward. And I'm acknowledging, as we all must, that we have a strong initial impulse to do the opposite. That we have a strong initial impulse to do the opposite. That's an obvious truth, but it's sometimes uncomfortable in communities like ours, right? We're a contemplative community. We're a meditation community, right? And so it's hard to say, like, well, the uncomfortable truth is that, gee, for most of the time, the fact is I do tend to avoid that which I don't know, that which I'm not certain of. I do have a habit. I've got a strongly ingrained habit to deny or ignore. Of course I do. I experience fear. Right. Right. Of course I do. Of course you do. We all do. Right. This avoidance of ours is a habit in the rest of our everyday life. So why would Zazen be any different? Right? We stick with our habits, the places and the thoughts and the emotions that are familiar, where we feel mastery, where it's well lit, where we understand it, right? Of course we do. This is a very, very human thing, but boy, the invitation of Zen is something else. We tend to stay in the places inside of ourselves that we are the safest. And I want to emphasize that for myself and my own experience, there are times when that was necessary. There are times when that was actually kind. There are times when it wasn't appropriate or healthy for me to explore, to go out to the edges. That wasn't a good thing for me to do. Times in my life when that would have been unwise. And I trust you know that experience too, right? There are times when just the walk around the neighborhood in the middle of the day is the best thing to do, right? Maybe on that walk, I can notice little bits that I hadn't seen before. I can notice change, but I don't necessarily have to go to the place that I have never gone in the middle of the night. I don't always have to do that. Nevertheless, with that acknowledgement, right, with that being said, I have to remind myself that the spirit of Buddhism is to know that which is not known and to bring light to that which is not illuminated, enlightenment, right? That is the spirit of the tradition, right? So the places inside of me that are well mapped and well illuminated are not the places that my Zazen needs to stay, right? Those are the safe neighborhoods. But staying there is not. the activity of enlightenment that can just be kind of self-soothing pain-killing. And enlightenment is way more dangerous, in a sense, at least to use our metaphor today, because by definition, enlightenment is a moment of discovering we haven't something we haven't seen before, going to a place we haven't been before, exploring a landscape of thought, of impulse, of emotion, of physicality that we have not experienced before, or at least experiencing in a new way, or at least experiencing it to another degree of depth we haven't experienced it before. It's new is the point. It's enlightenment. It's new. And so it's funny to me, actually, it's kind of strange that we tend almost universally to imagine that a moment of enlightenment would be a moment of pleasant, comfortable, even like bliss experience, right? When many of the moments of great discovery in our lives are not that. Sometimes moments of sudden and profound apprehension in our lives, discovering something really big, really new, having a giant new experience is oftentimes the opposite of that. I mean, there's quite a spectrum here, but you can sort of see, wow, they call it growing pains for a reason, right? So it's interesting that we have this idea that a moment of enlightenment will automatically be this really pleasant, wonderful, kind of transcendent, blissful thing, when the truth is seeing how pervasive my fear is, how pervasive the patterning of greed and acquisition is in my consciousness. Having a moment where you see just a little more, oh, that's how deep the anger and the hate go. Oh, that's a moment of enlightenment. I've just seen it. I didn't ever see it before. I didn't know it went down that deep. Now that I see it, I can make a choice. Now I have agency. Now I have influence. Now I'm actually walking the path. This is what it looks like. Is that a comfortable moment? No. But I'm more in alignment with truth. I'm much more in alignment with truth. That's the whole point. Reality as it is. Wow, it goes deep. Yes, yes, it does. That's a moment. Wow, right? So when I look at my own history with sitting and sitting and sitting and sitting, you know, day after day, month after month, year after year, I have to acknowledge that my general habit is the opposite of enlightenment. My general habit is still instinctual fear of that which I do not know. My general habit is still to stay with that which I know and I feel is safe and well-lit and organized and on the map, because that's how I experience comfort or pleasure or stress reduction or symptom management or whatever I want to call that. And as skillful as that often is, as well-needed as that sometimes is, I recognize that can't be the core of my practice. I can't just keep choosing to not see that which could be seen, that which is offering itself, right? Charlotte Joko Beck said, our practice must be careful, meticulous, patient. We must face everything. That to me sounds like another way of just describing the Bodhisattva vows. But I remember reading that when I was about 3 years into practice, maybe, because I bought Joko Beck's book at a used bookstore. I had no idea who she was or what it was part of. It was just a book that had Zen in the title. And I got that far in the book and I put it away because that sentence scared me so much. I had the opposite idea of what practice was about. And so I said, nope, no, thank you. And I circled back and then realized, thank you, Joko, for speaking truth. Our practice must be careful, meticulous, patient. We must face everything. That is a very different description of exploration. Right? This is my imaginary world here I'm holding up in front of you. Right? We want to explore all of it. We must know all of it. And the spirit in which that exploration happens is so important to us as Zen practitioners. It's so important to us as Buddhists. Central to everything we do is compassion. Central to everything we do is wisdom. Central to everything we do is about connection, connection, inclusion, inclusion, becoming one with, not rising above, not going below, right? It's this very central theme. We see it a trillion different ways in a trillion different passages. We face everything. We're in relationship with all of the parts of ourselves. We're in relationship with all the natural systems. We're in relationship with all of the peoples of the world throughout past, present, and infinite future in this tradition. There's nothing but relationship. That's what emptiness is, right? We must be in relationship with everything. That's why I'm emphasizing the fear part, because that's the thing that gets in the way. I imagine the dark. I imagine the danger. I'm not saying danger isn't real. I'm not saying darkness isn't real, but I'm just reminding us that's perception. That's this limited human being's perception. What's dark to me isn't dark to you. And what's fearful to me isn't fearful to you, and vice versa. So here, suddenly is the ground of my practice. Busho, sit with your fear. What is it telling you? What is it about? What does it go back to? What karmic patterns created it? Can you make friends with it? Can you connect with it? Can you relate to it? Can you separate the truth in it from the falsehood in it? That's my job. That's what I'm here to do, right? Wow. Let's look closely at this thing you call dark. Let's look closely at this thing that you are so adamant about reifying as dangerous. We really need to disarm, and that's where the disarming happens. Wow. Wow. Otherwise, I'm just obeying instinct. Otherwise, I'm just picking up a weapon, not even knowing, right? So we know. Of course we know. Science tells us this. Buddhism tells us this. Psychology tells us this. Fear obscures our vow. Fear gets in the way. Fear makes us stupid. It just does, right? We need it, of course, but we have to recognize its function for us. And as Buddhists, we're committed to looking very, very deeply at emotional states, especially afflictive emotional states, right? And so during Zazen, these very, very, very subtle moments show up that a lot of us I know today have the subtlety of awareness to recognize, oh, there's a pocket of fear. It showed up. It was there about a second and a half. It flickered, and there's an invitation there. And I can watch myself go, I'd rather go here, thank you. Or I can watch myself go, oh, what are you about? If I'm indeed a tiger taking to the mountains, if I'm indeed a dragon taking to the water, it's not a problem at all to investigate that, right? And so we must become refined enough, careful enough, meticulous enough in our awareness that we recognize those pockets of suffering and go to obey my vow right now is to go toward you because you are suffering. And I imagine that this is bodhisattva activity. The activity of enlightenment itself is to bring light to that which is dark, to bring freedom to that which is not free. That's what I'm here to do, right? If we're not careful, we can use instructions to kind of reinforce our fear. We can use even meditation instructions to reinforce the body of apprehension and anxiety that we all carry. The universal body. We can become like very, very fearful parents to ourselves, even during our meditation, and we can reinforce that fear. We can justify that fear by repeating our meditation instructions. You know, if we're not careful, we misunderstand. We misunderstand meditation instructions. Oh, there's some fear. No, 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 stay with the body, stay with the breath. Oh, I wonder about, no, 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 don't think. No, no, no thinking. Oh, I'm set, no, no feeling. Stay with the body, stay with the breath. Don't think, don't feel, don't go deeper, don't ask questions, don't wonder, don't explore. Stay with the body, stay with the breath. Don't think, don't feel, don't go deeper, don't ask. I've heard these instructions. I've practiced with these instructions for years. A lot of us have. I'm not making this up. You all have heard stuff like this, right? There's a wisdom at the beginning to knowing, hey, where's your body right now? Where's your breath right now? Do you notice when you wander? Notice when you come back. Really powerful, super, super helpful. And after a while, it creates in us a safe neighborhood where we can always just stay. And the beauty of creating that safety is I'm starting to learn I have influence over my experience of being alive. I'm not, in fact, a victim. I can create in my own mind a patch of safety, of immediate experience that is brilliantly powerful. But that's where Zazen is invited to begin. Now that you've got a safe sense of self, now that you've figured out you're a dragon, you can go into the mountains. Now that you've realized, oh no, wait, dragons go into the water and the air. Tigers go into the mountains. Actually, I can imagine dragons being helpful and comfortable any place. You know what I mean? When you figure it out. Right. Right. Oh, right. I can always come back here. I know what this is. I know who I am. This is okay. Poof, off I go. Off I go to the place I haven't been before. I'm big enough now to have the feeling I've been avoiding. I'm brave enough now to stop running. My eyes are big enough and clear enough. My heart is wise enough and strong enough to stop avoiding, right? I'm a grown up now. And so I can do grown up zazen. And I can start doing the wilderness practice that Dogen is encouraging me to do. Because staying on the map is not enlightenment. It's very literally refusing it. I will not learn something new. I will stay with that which I know is the opposite, the exact opposite of what we have been invited, implored, encouraged, begged to do for the past 2,500 plus years. We must face everything. So Dogen says, and I like his metaphors, he says the dragons explore the seas, and he says the tigers explore the mountains. Of course they do. I believe him. It's not lost on me that Dogen chose the image of dragons and tigers as his metaphors for our Buddha mind, for our Buddha nature, for our wise men, for your zazen. Remember, Fukan Zazengi is universally given, right? His audience for that piece, when he's using these metaphors, is everybody. So he's addressing you. That's your zazen he's talking about. That's your Buddha mind. You're the dragon. You're the tiger. These are images of ability, right? Ability, mastery, strength, courage, right? They're not images of owning or attaining or conquering. That's human. He doesn't use that as his image. He's reminding you of the nature of your original mind is able. It is upright. It is Buddha. It is strong. It is courageous. Of course you can go toward the dark. Wow. Not only is that your vow, but you're completely able and capable of doing that. That's the natural inclination of Buddha. That's what we do. It's as natural as reaching for the pillow in the dark, right? Our urge to explore with compassion is as natural to us as breathing. We absolutely can explore our own internal landscape with this very same spirit. We absolutely can. We practice it over and over and over, and we get better and better at doing it, but of course we can. We would never be invited to do it if we couldn't do it. Of course we can do it. That's the invitation, to see how we bloom in the darkness, to see the connection between how we put roots down into that which we do not know, like a plant does, and how something happens. Something just happens, doesn't it? It just happens. We have so many ways of knowing, so many ways of apprehension. There's some deeply wise part of every human being, I'm 100% convinced, that I already know is it's fine. Everything's already done, it's all fine. Everything's already awake. This is the activity of enlightenment. This is the thing right here. This is it. Right? What happens every spring? This is it. And so since I know that, since I have that awareness, since I can touch even a small part of that confidence, strength, I don't know, all these words seem too small to me. I immediately find in me the courage and the clarity and the compassion to move toward that which is darker or smaller or confused or doesn't know. Of course, it's no problem. Just like parents rush toward their kids when they fall and skin their knee, right? So our connection to our inner landscape, our connection to ourselves, the wildflower's connection to the night and to the soil that it's rooted in, the dragon's connection to the sky and to the water, the tiger's connection to the mountains, the way our light touches what it finds when we look inside, is of supreme importance. Please let yourself regard, the way you regard, the way you view, the way you explore, the way you perceive during zazen, right? Please let yourself regard, be curious. Please let it be exploring. Please let it be brave. You can trust anything you find there. There's no such thing as an unsafe neighborhood inside. Oh, there's pain, but you're Buddha. And over time, things will show themselves to you and you are able to see and know them. It's your nature, right? Kind, curious, allowing, connecting, right? Wildflowers so connected to the dark, roots so comfortable there in the cool, moist earth. I marvel at their comfort. I marvel at their lack of doubt about their own belonging. Faces held out bare, aimed into the heart of the infinite sky, reminding us, imploring us, hold it all like water in your hands. Each drop of memory, each drop of pain, hold it in warm heart palms, lest it freeze, harden, and return to invisibility and become suffering. Become something with a higher body count than the simple, safe, trustworthiness of pain that tethers us to this shimmering world. So I'll end with Issa again. Such intricate wildflowers bloomed in one short night. And my hope for all of us, both in this little community and in our infinitely large community, is that this very moment is one of those short nights that give rise to blooming. I appreciate your attention today. Thank you so much for listening to me. I encourage you to explore this poem on your own and see what blooming it causes in your own heart. Thank you.